I thought this would be a nice opportunity to talk about the Sandokai, and what I'd like to try and do is get all the way through it, so it won't be in great depth, but it'll be kind of an overview. There's this book by Shunryu Suzuki called Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness, and talks on the Sandokai. This has got two other translations in it which I'm going to refer to. I'm not going to refer specifically to Suzuki Roshi's commentary, but that's another book, another resource. One of them is a official or at least semi-official Soto Shu translation. Soto Shu is the Japanese Soto Zen organization. They translate the title as The Harmony of Difference and Equality. And then there's also, although Suzuki Roshi didn't produce a whole translation of it, he translated it kind of character by character as he went through talking about it, and that's been kind of assembled into a version by him at the end, translated as Oneness of One and Many. And Harmony of Difference and Equality, I think we often translate it as something like the merging of difference and unity, or the holding both together. It's the idea of the all is different, the myriad of different things, and then there's also the sense of all existence, Buddha nature, and then there's holding those two together, or the fact that those two are there together, are present together. It starts off with, from west to east unseen flowed out the mind of India's greatest sage, and to the source kept true as an unsullied stream is clear. And this is the start of, well, for us when we do it as part of a ceremony, it's the start of morning office, and it starts the whole thing off really with a statement of certainty, a statement of how things are. That's the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha flowing out. And as it does so, keeping true to the source as an unsullied stream is clear. And for me, I think that's an important pointer to how practice works and how the passing on of the tradition works. A tradition passed down for 2,500 years over 80-odd generations, you could say, well, doesn't it just get diluted along the way? How does it stay true to that source? And the way that it stays true to the source is that each of us in each generation, we have to connect directly with the source. It's not about connecting to the end of a line. It's the teaching that's passed down points us in the direction, or shows us how we ourselves can come to know that source. And that's how it keeps true to the source, as an unsullied stream is clear, as it says in the translation. It doesn't become sullied and diluted with other things, because we each of us come to know it directly. Although by wit and dullness the true way is varied, yet it has no patriarch of south or north. This is beginning to explore the difference and unity aspect. We're all different as individuals. The true way is varied in the sense that we each walk it as is real for us, depending on our own particular attributes. But nevertheless, we can't divide it into different ways. It's all one way. It's all the true way. However we walk it, it's always the true way. There had been a division between southern and northern schools of Buddhism, but I didn't mention this Sandokai is written by Sekito Kisen, who is one of the earliest teachers in the line that descends from Shakyamuni to Bodhidharma, and then on from then. Sekito is the disciple of Seigen Gyoshi, who himself was a disciple of the sixth ancestor, Daiken Enno. And he's saying very clearly, although there has been this so-called division into the northern and southern school, really there aren't two different ways. So this is already beginning to explore difference in unity. But I think it's really with the next verse that he starts to explore it in more detail. Here born we clutch at things and then compound illusion later on by following ideals. The Sotoshu version says, the mind of India, of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. And then there are these two lines. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. And then it comes on to, grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. We start off by grasping at the myriad things in the sense that we see the universe as made up of individual things and we have some kind of relationship to them, which might be a, if they're things we don't like, pushing away type relationship, or if they're things we do like, it might be a pulling towards us type relationship. But both of them are attachment. And as we go on, we see that there is that attachment and we see that there is that discriminative mind that we judge things as being good or bad or as being things we like or things we don't like. As we see that and train with that and in seeing the suffering of it, wish to let go of that, it's quite easy for us then to grasp at a unity. But there isn't this division between all the myriad things. Everything is Buddha. And it's not so clear in our translation. And then compound delusions later on by following ideals. I think the Sotoshu version is quite helpful. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. So grasping at the unity is still not it. We start out saying everything's different. And then perhaps after a while we start saying everything's the same. He's pointing out here that that also isn't enough. It's still just seeing with one eye. Each sense gate and its object all together enter thus in mutual relations and yet stand apart in a uniqueness of their own, depending and yet non-depending both. And that, again, that's our interaction with all the myriad things. There is a relationship between us and other objects that we encounter. And it's true at the same time that they stand apart in a uniqueness of their own. We see them as individual things, and we might perceive them as being separate from us. But also there is a mutual entering into together, otherwise we wouldn't be able to sense them. The senses depend on the objects to provide a perception for us, and yet they're not depending either. We are us and the objects are themselves. But when we perceive things, in form and feel, component things are seen to differ deeply. Thus our voices in inherent isolation, soft or harsh. This is the myriad things in all their different forms. The Sotoshu translation says, sights vary in quality and form, sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. And this is our everyday experience of things, that there's variation between things. And then in the next sentence, it says, in our translation, such words as high and middle darkness match. Light separates the murky from the pure. That seems a bit obscure. And this is where he starts using the idea of the dark and the light. And the dark and the light here aren't meant to be good and bad. They're not meant to be delusion and enlightenment. It's much more the idea of darkness being the all is one, in the sense that within darkness there isn't discrimination of different things, there's just all is dark or all is seen as being the same. But when we shine a light on a particular thing, when there is light, we discriminate between things. And as he'll come on to say later on, this analogy of darkness and light, they don't stand against each other, they're both there at the same time. Such words as high and middle darkness match. refined and common speech come together in the dark. So within the dark, we don't distinguish between refined and common speech. They just come together. We see the unity of them. But clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. So when we see things as separate, we can distinguish between clear and murky. So the light, the discerning, has a function that helps us see the differences between things. But if we only know that, then we miss out on the commonality between them. The properties of the four elements together draw, just as a child returns unto its mother. Other translations say, the four elements resume their nature as a child has its mother, or the four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. I guess it's a sense of seeing things as they really are, seeing the four elements as the four elements, as aspects of reality, and we can also see the differences between them. So there's the heat of fire, the moving wind, the water wet, and the earth all solid. And then our sense perceptions as well. With eyes we see, sounds heard and smells, upon the tongue the sour, salty taste. That's all the differences. And then he says, and yet, in each related thing, as leaves grow from the roots, end and beginning here return unto the source, and high and low are used respectively. Again, I find it helpful to look at some of the other translations. So after the four elements and the sense perceptions, thus for each and every thing, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. So the analogy of the leaves spreading from the root. Leaves grow from the root. The leaves then are the myriad different things, but they all come from the same root. There's the trunk and branches share the essence, as this translation says. It's finding many different ways to point to the fact that at the same time there are the individual things that we see, the individual leaves, and at the same time there's a commonality there. They come from a common source, or there is the common element to them as well. It's bringing out that aspect that when we use words, when we use high and low, we tend to set up an absolute discrimination in our mind. We set things up against each other, and in doing that we tend to lose sight of or lose the presence of the commonality between them. And then he brings it all together really with this next few lines, which you could say are the heart of the whole thing. Within all light is darkness, but explained it cannot be by darkness that one-sided is alone. In darkness there is light, but here again, by light one-sided, it's not explained. Light goes with darkness, as the sequence does of steps in walking. So it takes the, you could say, two modes of existence, takes them one at a time. First of all, light. Even within the myriad things appearing, there is the commonality. But if we only see it as the commonality, then that doesn't explain the whole thing. But similarly, if we only see it as the individuals, then that also doesn't explain it. It's not the whole of existence. We're only seeing it from one particular side. I'm not that keen on the Soto Shoes version of that. In light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another. Like front and back foot in walking. I think you could say don't take it as darkness only. I think it's not saying that it isn't darkness, it's just that it isn't only darkness. Within brightness actually there is utter darkness, but you should not meet someone just with darkness. Within darkness there is brightness, but you should not see others only with the eyes of brightness. So whether we see things as individual or as all is one, whichever way we tend to see them, we shouldn't see them only that side. We lose the other side and we lose the full view. And that's brought together in this line, light goes with darkness. Light and darkness form a whole together. They're two sides of the same coin, like form and emptiness together. It's one existence. And the analogy used for that is walking. In our translation it says, as the sequence does of steps in walking. Suzuki Roshi simply says, like one foot forward and the other behind in walking. Soto shoes one light and dark oppose one another, like front and back foot in walking. I think that's a very strange word to use, mm-hmm. oppose one another. I think ours, I'd say, as the sequence does of steps in walking, doesn't seem quite right to me in the sense that sequence seems to convey one after another, alternating. Whereas I'd say that the whole analogy of the steps in walking is that it's a combination, it's the two together. In the sense that when we step forward with a right foot, and we might say that's a right step, actually our whole weight is being carried by our left foot, our left leg, and the same the other way round. And in a way that's light and darkness. There's what's visible is stepping forward with the right foot. We see our right foot going in front of us, but we don't see what's actually supporting us, the left foot. So it's the combination, and it's only through the combination we have the whole thing. All things herein have inherent great potentiality, both function, rest, reside within. I think that second line, both function, rest, reside within, it is a little bit confusing. It means both function and rest reside within. It's activity and stillness together, yeah. Which is another aspect of the light and darkness together. All things herein have inherent great potentiality. When we see the combination of all is one and all is different, then we can fully value what things are, what they already are. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Or everything, all beings have their own virtue. You should know how to apply this truth. If we only see things as individuals, then we don't fully appreciate the connectedness of everything. We don't really see the great potentiality. And within our own being, function and rest, activity and stillness are already inherent. They are the two aspects of the stillness of the darkness, you could say, where things aren't differentiated, but also the function of the light, where things very definitely are differentiated. Were there no differentiation, there could be no function, because what would that mean if all is one? But if we only see the differentiation and the function, then where is the rest within that? Where is there the rest within the mind of all existence is Buddha? And these two coming together, the ideal and the actual, again you could say the ideal and the actual is the all existence, Buddha nature, which isn't an ideal, but the nature of things being undifferentiated comes together with the actual in the sense of the individual manifestations, the myriad things. And there's the two analogies of like a box with its lid, or like two arrows that meet in midair. And the Soto Shu translation has phenomena exist like box and lid joining, principle accords like arrow points meeting. Completely understand herein the basic truth within these words. One of these translations has hearing the words, understand the meaning. And the other has, when you listen to the words, you should understand the source of the teaching. Again, it's expression and truth. It's the myriad forms in which the words can appear. but looking beyond the words, not getting caught in the words, that the words themselves aren't the truth. They're pointers to the truth, but through understanding them we can find our way to the truth. It's not mistaking the finger for the moon, but also realising that finger and moon are of one nature as well, as Master Daishin's pointed out. And then this really important one, lo, here, set up not your own standards. Don't establish your own rules, says Suzuki Roshi in the Soto Shu version is. Don't set up standards of your own. So they all have the same meaning, that we shouldn't set up our own ideals of, or our own ideas of how reality is, but rather we should explore it and see what is its nature. And I think all the way through in everything we do, it's a good reminder, don't set up your own standards. How do we negotiate all of this? How do we find our way to seeing the true nature of things? And that's what this last section is about. If from your experience of the senses, basic truth you do not know, how can you ever find the path that certain is, no matter how far distant you may walk? As you walk on, distinctions between near and far are lost. If from the experience of your senses, basic truth you do not know, we have to come to know things directly. It's not enough to know about them, to have read about them in a book, or to have heard someone else talking about them. We have to know it directly. I think the other two translations both help point to what that's about. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? If we have an idea of a path ahead of us that somehow we will come to know, then we're just following an ideal. If we want to know the path as we walk it, we have to know the path at this very moment, because the path at this moment and the path as we walk forward aren't two different things. If we think we're not on the path, or we're not yet at the goal, then we're distinguishing between practice and enlightenment. If we want to know the true nature of things, we have to know them right now. Because practice is not a matter of far or near. Or as our translation says, as you walk on, distinctions between near and far are lost. It's not a question of it being here or it being elsewhere. If you don't practice in your everyday life as you walk, how can you know the way? The goal is neither far nor near. We might have ideas occurring to us of how far in the future it will be, or whether it's here, or whether it's going to be soon. But those are just ideas, they're just thoughts. We have to let go of those thoughts of it being far or near. And as we walk on, those distinctions drop away, because we realise that we're just binding ourselves with those distinctions. And then the last bit sounds a bit scary, but I think is actually very supportive. And should you lost become, there will arise obstructing mountains and great rivers. If we're paying attention, then the arising of what seem to be obstructions are an indication that we're not going the right way. So they're bodhisattvas arising that point out to us that we've become a little bit lost. And the very seeing things of as obstructing mountains and great rivers that block our way is a seeing things only as differences. And it's a seeing things as me being in confrontation with reality or with the things I come across. Every obstacle, everything that we meet can be the expression of the way in that moment if we see it as being that. The other translations are, I think, helpful. If you stick to the idea of good or bad, you will be separated from the way by high mountains or big rivers. Well, this one I particularly like. But if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. not because mountains and rivers block our way, but because we're not seeing clearly, because we're confused. And in our confusion, we see the terrain of our life as being things that block our way. And this is particularly so if we have an idea of it being far or near. If we think it's off in the future and we have to get there, then it's really annoying if there's all these mountains and rivers. If we realise that it's here already, then the mountains and rivers are beautiful scenery. They are the expressions of the truth all around us. And then it finishes with this very nice line: "This I offer to the seeker of great truth. Do not waste time. Don't pass your days and nights in vain." Or, "Seekers of the truth, don't spend your time in vain."